Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rader.
And we're joined today by Ahmed Best in the house. How you doing, Ahmed?
Hello. I'm good, thank you. How are you guys?
Doing great. Great to have you here. You are the creator and host of Afrofuturism, the podcast, and perhaps best known for your acting work on lots of shows and movies, but perhaps most famously as Jar Jar Binks on Star Wars.
That is correct. That is what I am most known for.
Is that what you get asked about the most, is Star Wars stuff?
Yeah, it is. I get asked a lot about it. But, you know, the Afrofuturist podcast is actually becoming as equally asked about as the Star Wars stuff, because most people don't know what Afrofuturism is and what the podcast is about. So when I start talking about it, usually brings up a lot of just fascinating questions, which I'm more than happy to answer and be a part of. So it's kind of evening out now.
Do you want to start with your podcast and why you started it and maybe talk a little bit about Afrofuturism?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of all lanes leaded towards this, you know, hanging out with George Lucas a lot when we were doing all of the movies. He was very focused on the future. He was always looking towards what was next. He was looking to innovate constantly, and he was always focused on younger generations, you know. And he had these like 10-year, 20-year kind of forecasts for things, especially in things Star Wars and entertainment. And I always enjoyed having those conversations with him because I was a big science fiction fan growing up. And I love anything that has to do with, you know, future centuries and sci-fi and space exploration and all of that kind of stuff. Like I was huge into that as a kid, growing up in New York and hanging out at the Hayden Planetarium and getting all of those like astrophysics, astronomy influences in my life from that. So I really loved how he was able to not just think and forecast the future, but actually affect the future. And Afrofuturism, which was a term coined in the very recent future.
Early 90s, I believe.
Yeah. And it's really about this idea that futurist thinking didn't start in Italy during the futurist movement in the 20s and 30s. That futurist thinking started 10,000 years before the pyramids, and African people have always been future thinking and future moving. And that history has gotten lost. So the types of futurist thinking that predates the ancient Egyptians is where we start from in Afrofuturism, as well as how we look towards the stars and how we look towards the future. Also in African ancestry, there's this idea of looking back to the ancestors in order to look forward. If you were a fan of the Black Panther movie, one of the things that makes it kind of a staple in Afrofuturist fiction and speculative fiction is the fact that he had this ability to talk to the ancestors.
Right.
He can talk to his father. And then there was that big scene. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. Black Panther's kind of old now. But there was that big scene where he was actually telling the ancestors that they were wrong. They all were wrong. Right. So one of the hardcore tenets of Afrofuturism is this ability to look back in order to look forward. So that's really the foundation of where Afrofuturist thinking starts. And that's what we try to talk about on the podcast, regardless of whether or not you are an artist or a fiction writer or a science fiction writer or a technologist or scientist. Like, those are the ideas that help facilitate Afrofuturist thinking.
You mentioned the pyramids, and obviously the pyramids, there's a lot of mystery around how those were built. And I'm just wondering if you brought up the pyramids because Afrofuturism attempts to touch on the origins of things like the pyramids, or if you were just bringing that up because it's, you know, like an old landmark that nobody knows where it came from.
Well, I mean, people do know where it came from. Africans built them.
Of course,
and, Neil deGrasse Tyson has this wonderful quote where he's just like, just because you can't figure out how it's built doesn't mean that it was built by aliens. And I know a lot of, there's a lot of speculation that, you know, aliens from outer space came down and showed, you know, how to build these things. But honestly, there's no evidence of that. And that's not the case. But what there is evidence of are, you know, African people having the geometric scientific ability to create these forms and build these forms to laser perfect measurements as well. Like there have been excavations of pyramids and looking at the actual blocks that the pyramids are built on. And there was a device that the Egyptians created that used the magnification of the sun to cut the stone, which was like the early form of a laser. So these things are not myth. All of this information is out there. It's just the dissemination of that information is very few and far between for a lot of different reasons. But the idea that building things for future generations and thinking about having the ability to think about the future has always been a tenet in African thinking and African diasporic thinking. So it's not something that, you know, we have just stumbled upon, and it's not something that started in the early 20th century.
But is this something that's actually really debated? Because, you know, it seems like from what we know about migration and out of Africa and all that stuff, that this forward thinking would have had to originated in Africa, because that's where it all began.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's not anything that's really been debated. I think it's the information about it has slowly been trickling out, and that's the challenge, right? The challenge is not the fact that the information isn't available. It's the fact that the distribution of the information is a very, very slow drip. And we're trying to open up the faucet and have it be more of a waterfall than a drip.
What kind of information are you talking about? I hate that I'm dominating this conversation, Andrew, but I've just got so many questions.
No, that's a really great question. And all great questions about this are fantastic, because the information about African people having the metallurgical, having the astronomical, having the mathematical skill to actually create objects, to create civilizations, to create blossoming civilizations, and acquire and accrue physical, mental, and emotional wealth far beyond that seen in the West at the time, at the exact same time. Those are the bits of information that don't seem to be coming out. There's a very strong Western dominant idea that, you know, scientific thinking and the scientific method started in the West, started in Europe, started in the United States or the Americas. And that's actually just not the case. you know, the reason why we have algebra and algorithms and all of those things, those are mathematical and scientific terms that were created during the Renaissance of the Islamic era. And that all took place in what we now call North Africa and the Middle East. And Westerners, the Greeks and the Romans, came down through Africa to acquire this knowledge and brought it back up. And eventually this knowledge was the catalyst for the Renaissance, right? It was the catalyst for the Age of Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. But all of the Age of Reason ideas came from Africa, Saharan and Sub-Saharan. So it's that information that is not as well spread. And that's the information that we're trying more to make a dominant part of the conversation.
Talking about African kingdoms, so a lot of people probably aren't aware that the richest person in history was African, Mansa Musa, right, from Mali.
Yeah, that's right.
And there were huge kingdoms in Africa that were far larger than anything in Europe and more technologically advanced at the time in the 1300s, basically, as you say. It was connected to the North African and European world across the caravan routes. But I think Sub-Saharan Africa also had a completely separate Iron Age and development of metallurgy, and people are sort of even less aware of that. Like there were large kingdoms in Zimbabwe, giant cities, giant walled cities. And the Kingdom of Congo, for example, is another one. And like when the Portuguese arrived in Congo, they found this kingdom that was like far wealthier than they were, right? And you know, more organized and stuff, and they were just basically surprised by it. And so I think that's sort of how people are today, rediscovering this, kind of surprised about it.
Yeah, and these things were happening all over the world, you know, when in the 15th century, when the Spanish started exploring the New World, North America, they get to the kingdoms of the Mayans and the kingdoms of the Aztecs, and it's the same thing. They have a mathematical knowledge of the stars that is far beyond their thinking, the European thinking, the Spanish thinking, and they build these fantastical pyramids. And then, of course, you have the just tremendous treasures of gold in these areas. And, you know, those ancient civilizations were literally wiped off the face of the earth. And that gold goes to fund what we now know as, you know, Spain and France and England. I mean, they built their entire government structures on stolen gold, stolen land, and enslavement of indigenous people and genocide. So there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in these facts. And personally, I try to take that out of it and just go, well, this is what actually happened. These are the facts, regardless of how you feel about them. This is what happened. And that history and that knowledge to me is important, you know. And the same part of your brain that recognizes the past recognizes the future. You can conceive of the past just as easily as you can conceive of the future, because that's how your brain works.
It's all arguably imagination.
Yeah. And you know, we put together these stories in our brains to talk about the past, and we seem to be all right with the past. But there's kind of an obsession right now, especially in like the self-help world, where everybody's talking about being in the present. And so we are very fixated on the past and the present. But as far as we know, we're the only animals on this planet that can conceive of and create the future. Yet and still, there are a large group of human beings that are encouraged not to think about it, right? And especially in Black and brown communities, we're encouraged not to think about it because we want to be, the idea of control is to be kept in this constant present where you're scrapping and scrounging to survive, right? However, when you are put in those dire situations, you can't help but think about the future, right? Every spiritual in enslavement is about when we will be free. Not if, but when, right? And that's future thinking. Follow the Drinking Gourd is a song that the enslaved Africans would sing to one another to find the North Star, right? Follow the Drinking Gourd is the dipper in the little dipper in the night sky. That North Star led them north to freedom. That's astronomy thinking. That's astrophysics thinking. That's future thinking. So it's always been a part of African culture. It's always been a part of indigenous culture. And it can't help but be flourish and propagate. And so the podcast really is about talking about that type of thinking, right? Not necessarily moving people to think that way, but when I interview people on the podcast, it really is about how they are looking back to look forward. How does the future play into what they're doing now, and how we can conceive of all three, past, present, and future.
Ahmed, you said earlier that there was you mentioned that there was knowledge, ancient knowledge that was lost, and that European explorers would stumble upon these ancient African civilizations who had superior knowledge about a, you know, myriad of different topics. And I'm just, so I'm just wondering, is the basis of Afrofuturism that, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, there were pockets of advanced knowledge and wisdom in these specific African cultures, and that those civilizations were wiped out, and so that knowledge was lost?
To a certain extent, I think there's this strong believability, and this is kind of, you know, the world is kind of obsessed with white supremacy. And there's this strong belief that Black people do not have the capacity to think this way. And during enslavement, people were ripped apart. They were ripped from their families. They were ripped from their tribes. They were ripped from their language, beliefs, religion. And they were ripped from their knowledge, from their science. And this was a concerted effort to degrade what, you know, we had, as Black people, had to fight for our humanity. You know, as Black people, when we were enslaved and brought to this country, we were not considered people.
Right.
So when you are dehumanized, it's very easy to say that you do not have the capacity for any type of advanced thought. So these civilizations that existed, that had these advancements in science and so forth, were not believed to have existed. You know, there was this empire called the Kush Empire, and the Kush Empire actually took over Egypt and the Egyptians, and the Kush people were dark-skinned Africans. And the first European archaeologist to study the Kush Empire could not believe that they were dark-skinned Africans. No, I mean, just complete disbelief of it. So when he sees the hieroglyphics of dark-skinned Africans with such an advanced civilization, he believes it's a caricature or a depiction of something else and not actual people, right? And that's the detriment and poison of white supremacy, you know? And that's what's propagated this idea that African civilizations didn't have the capacity to have this type of sophistication when it came to science, mathematics, language, so forth.
So Afrofuturism isn't so much an attempt to explain ancient mysteries or things like that as it is a way to combat the idea that complex society originated in the West.
That's correct. And it also speculates on the fact that imagine if we didn't try to erase that history. How far advanced as a human race on this planet would we be?
Maybe I'm wrong, but to me, the word connotes something kind of like Black Lives Matter in a sense, because obviously I think we're all concerned with kind of futurism in general, and I know what that means. In a sense, though, I think it's maybe calling out the specific contributions of Africans and maybe trying to kind of motivate and energize that kind of thinking, like that, hey, African, like just kind of highlighting the specific contributions in a sense. Because, like, for example, like with Black Lives Matter, obviously, to some extent, all lives matter, but Black Lives Matter makes sense as a movement and as a statement, because historically that it hasn't been recognized that you know, Africans are Black people are just as important as white people, so it needs a specific emphasis. It needs a specific...
Yeah.
Kind of motivate, like, so that's why, you know, and it's the same sense, like, mm-hmm. It's like, obviously we all believe that futurism is important, but because historically the achievements and the contributions and the abilities of Black people have been denied so much, maybe it's quite reasonable to have this kind of futurism focus, right? Is that kind of right, or am I missing something?
No, I mean, I think they all kind of line up in the exact same way, and I think when we talk about things like Black Lives Matter, we're still asking for permission to exist. And we're still asking for those who don't believe Black Lives Matter to realize that they do. And personally, I'm not interested in that. I don't ask permission to matter or not. You know, that it, for me, that's understood. You know what I'm saying? So if you try to, or if anyone tries to erase my existence, they're going to come up against very strong opposition. I don't need to ask anyone to recognize my humanity. My humanity is inherent in my existence.
Yeah, no one should have to ask for that.
Right. And, you know, with Afrofuturism, what we're saying is, regardless of whether you believe it or not, this is what it is. This happened. And if you are denying that this has happened, you're really denying reality, and you're not living in a way that will enhance your future and your life, you know? Because the more humans that are involved with advancing humanity, the stronger humanity becomes.
I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it more about changing the perception of history? And maybe it is, I'm just kind of asking, or is it more about kind of energizing, you know, Africans for the future now? I mean, is it kind of correcting our, and maybe it's probably both, but is it kind
of, I think it's
talking
both
about the technological development of Africa, you know, like solar panels and kind of making sure Africans are like part of the future and, you know, just kind of recognizing that this is the future we want? Or is it, I guess, more focused on correcting perceptions of the past, or maybe both at the same time?
I think it's both. I think correcting the record is a big deal. But I also believe that, you know, within the paradigms of white supremacy, there is this hierarchy that exists. That doesn't exist in African countries. Even when we talk about the idea of patriarchy, most tribal organizations in Africa are matriarchal. Mm-hmm. Or there's a patriarch and a matriarch, and they're equal. The idea that there is one patriarch that has absolute control over everyone and everything that happens in a monarchy with absolute power, that really doesn't exist in tribal systems, right? It can't. If one person makes a bad decision, that could kill an entire tribe, right? Because there aren't very many people in the tribe. So those types of dynamics don't exist the way we know them to exist in the West. Those are very Western ideas, right? Even in China, in the East, in the Far East, in India and in China, those ideals were Western ideas, right? And we have modern China the way we have because of communism and Mao Zedong and Marxism. It has very little to do with inherent Chinese culture, right? So we're all fighting this battle against Western ideas. And we have to decide as a human race what's the best for us in order for us to continue.
It seems that Afrofuturism has both social and historical bases, but I'm wondering, and I think that, you know, I agree completely that both are important. I'm just still trying to figure out what historical, if there are any specific historical distinctions that they make or arguments that they make, or is there any like specific knowledge that they claim was wiped out that is trying to be reintroduced, or is it more of just like a general acknowledgement of the origins of complex society in Africa?
Well, I mean, here are a couple of big things. Egypt is considered the Middle East, and Egypt is firmly on the continent of Africa.
Of course, yeah.
So the question becomes, why is it looked on as the Middle East and not Africa?
I have an opinion. It might not be right.
Because it was basically conquered by Arabs in 600. Like, I mean, so the elites who ruled Egypt for the last 1,500 years have been from the Middle East, basically. I think that's the reason.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the Egyptian culture comes from the Arabs, right?
Yeah, and I wouldn't disagree, but the country of Egypt is still firmly on the African continent.
Of course,
you know, that's a technical. That's technical, sure. And everyone who lives in Egypt, they are, regardless of where they came from, are Africans.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Right.
But yet and still, our perception or what the perception of Egypt is the Middle East. And it also has a lot to do with the fact that there are examples of an advanced civilization there, and no one wants to believe Black Africans could build that.
Yeah. It's kind of like the China-Taiwan conflict.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, North Africa has always been separated from sub-Saharan Africa just by the giant desert for a long time. So it's had sort of this slightly different culture, like the Berbers and that kind of thing. The agriculture has been different and everything like that. So, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. North Africa is part of Africa.
But there was a civilization called the ancient civilization of Yam, which were sub-Saharan Africans that actually created what we now know as ancient Egypt. And they traveled north through sub-Saharan Africa and established what we know now as ancient Egypt. And the way ancient Egyptians dress, the way they think, the ability to create pottery and build the pyramids and the gods and the folklore. And the civilization of Yam were the first, they were the first civilization to chart the stars. And they believed they charted the rise and the fall of the Nile River. And that education moved straight up into ancient Egypt to the point where the three pyramids of Giza are in direct alignment with Orion's Belt. So these are ancient African civilizations that were building, physically building structures in direct correlation with astrophysics. And this is 10,000 years before the Sphinx was even built, you know? So we're not even talking about the Arab migration or the migration from what was then Mesopotamia from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers into Egypt or throughout the North Africa. We're talking 10,000 years before that. So
you're talking like roughly 20,000 BCE or something like that?
Yeah. That effect. And there are artifacts. There are there's a really great book called Black Genesis that talks about all of this stuff. And this type of information doesn't really come out in mainstream education. And, you know, there are several reasons why. I believe that there is a fear of this kind of advanced technology being known to the rest of the world, that Black people or African people had the capacity to do this so long ago.
Yeah.
It's a big blow to white supremacy. It's just a huge blow to white supremacy, and they're afraid of that.
So I want to say something. You brought up Black Panther earlier, which it's hard to talk about Afrofuturism without bringing up Black Panther because it's such a great movie.
Yeah.
I loved Black Panther. And I'm just wondering about this timeline of 20,000 BCE and whether or not, and I'm not doubting it. I have questions because, you know, agriculture wasn't developed until, you know, roughly 10,000 BCE. And so, you know, technology would have only been so specialized even at 10,000 BCE. So how could technology have progressed at 20? And obviously, like, the pyramids are a mystery. It's no mystery as to who built them. Obviously, they weren't built by aliens. So I'm not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously some kind of lost technology that built things and developed things that we've lost information on. And I'm not discounting any of that. But I am curious about this 20,000 BCE argument because agriculture hadn't happened yet, at least widespread. Migration hadn't happened yet. At least widespread. And so I'm curious what there is to know about this technology at 20,000 BCE and how we can know definitively that people were involved with the stars and this really specialized technology so early on.
Yeah. Yeah. If you research Black Genesis, you'll see that there have been that argument has been actually just destroyed. There was agriculture, there was charting of the stars, and there are artifacts found in sub-Saharan Africa that show a migration between the Yam civilization up to Egypt. And it was like a migration that no one thought could be done. There are not only pottery artifacts, there are cave paintings and rock paintings of these civilizations making these migrations in their, and also in their daily lives. The civilization of Yam doesn't exist anymore. They became ancient Egyptians, right? And there was a faction of the Yam civilization that stayed in sub-Saharan Africa and then disappeared. But there's a lot that we still don't know. There's a lot that we're still trying to figure out. But what we thought to have believed about agriculture and migration is a falsity.
The timeline is a falsity, is what you're saying.
The timeline of when we thought those things began, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. It definitely seems to at least present a very strong answer to things like how and when did the pyramids happen and the sphinxes happen and things like that. And I'm looking at this. I've never heard of this Black Genesis book. I'm going to check it out by Robert Bouval. It looks super interesting.
That's it.
So, this is very interesting stuff.
So there's different kinds of agriculture. And I think that like in the highlands in New Guinea, Jared Diamond was talking about for tens of thousands of years, people are growing taro. So it's not just like wheat, right? Like I think wheat started like 10,000 years ago. And actually, maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but when I was listening to you talk about the different kind of development of cultures and how the patriarchy developed, you know, more in Europe and things like that, I'm wondering if it's actually connected to that directly. Everything on this podcast seems to go back to agriculture. I think that's how we started. Everything, even civilization, goes back to agriculture. But the thing about wheat and barley and rye and the European kind of crops are that they're the easiest ones to stockpile. And so they kind of allow the most specialization, which is kind of why, you know, technology was really rapid growth in Europe, but maybe started earlier in other places and things like that. Whereas like African is like agriculture is like yams and sorghum and millet and other things that maybe are not as easy to stockpile and maybe require more kind of communal effort. Like in China, in southern China, at least, they grow mostly rice. In northern China, they do have a lot of wheat. That's just a very different crop, and so you need a lot more intensive cultivation year-round, whereas wheat, you kind of just plant it. And there's a lot of work, it's specific times, and then you harvest it, and you store it in granaries, and it's kind of like a much more portable piece of property that you can kind of give around, and it's kind of like accumulates wealth, and it kind of accumulates power structures and that kind of thing. So I think it might be like really related to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is your point, Andrew, that those crops travel better and so they were more conducive to migration or something?
No, not at all. My point is I'm wondering if the cultural differences, because humans are all the same, basically, like genetically, humans are so similar. Like compared to other animals, we're basically like all twins or clones or something like that. We're so genetically similar despite outward appearances. And so obviously cultural differences must arise from somewhere. And obviously the most fundamental piece of civilization, element of civilization, is agriculture. And obviously agriculture has throughout history determined the haves and the have-nots and how you accumulate wealth and power and how it's distributed and that kind of thing. And so this power structure of hierarchy and stuff really kind of seems like it would develop based on a wheat agriculture that's a really portable form of wealth that can be amassed and stockpiled and stuff like that.
I'm laughing, but you're right. It's totally true.
Like an agriculture that's more intensive, like yams or something, and like taro is just like a lot more labor intensive. So it's harder to accumulate wealth, and therefore it's harder for people to steal the wealth, basically, like kings and stuff like that. And you don't get this kind of power structure. I don't know if this idea has already been widely explored or if this is like a new book that I just thought of right now.
Wheat is patriarchal.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has this theory that, and he hasn't really explored this very much, but I remember him talking about it, why Asian societies have a lot more proclivity towards mathematics and a lot more patience. And he speculated it's because they're a rice culture. Mm. Rice is very specific, right? Rice takes a long time to cultivate. You have to constantly watch it. You have to plant it at a specific time, pull it at a specific time. It's incredibly labor intensive. And then eventually you have to count. And these are very small grains to count and weigh. So he said culturally, they probably have more of a proclivity towards math because of wow. the patience it takes and the specificity it takes to grow rice. I don't know how far he's gone into that theory, but I found it interesting.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And like, so what I'm suggesting is maybe because African agriculture, and I don't know if it is, I'm just kind of throwing it out there, it requires kind of more cooperation or something like that. Maybe it leads to more like communal structures or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And more tribal structures. It's a lot like the structures in, indigenous Americans, you know, they needed to be able to eat and travel and sustain themselves in these tribes. So they developed, a tribal situation that is both matriarchal and patriarchal. So they can control how they survive, right? So each tribe had a tribal council, and those tribal councils had both a male and female figurehead of the tribe. So, you know, men wouldn't rush off into war. The matriarch would slow them down and say, think about this first before you go off into war. And, you know, women wouldn't rush off and move. Men were like, think about this first before we pack up, because it's very labor intensive. Mm-hmm. And this is how many people we have in the tribe. And this is how many children we have in the tribe. And a lot of the tenets of the Constitution of the United States came from these, you know, tribal ideas. The Iroquois Nation. The Iroquois Nation came, you know, they inspired Ben Franklin. They inspired, you know, they inspired Thomas Jefferson, and those tenets came into the United States Constitution. So tribal systems were enacting their ideas in a democratic way, you know, before the United States. I mean, we're kind of America's probably one of the first modern democracies, you know. Europe, there were monarchies. So, those tribal ideas, especially the tribal ideas of gender equality, are tenets inherent in tribal people.
You are what you eat, I guess. I guess that's the lesson of this episode.
Very much so.
So, I hear these stories about people who, develop software companies and they really want to, and then they move back to God. There was a famous American who worked for Microsoft, I think, and he was originally from Ghana or something like that. And he went back and he really wanted to kind of make his mark there and help Africa develop its own technologies and stuff. Do you talk about that at all? Like, I mean, what are your hopes for constantly the future development of the African continent?
I'm extremely optimistic and interested in the future development of the African continent. There is a really big danger, though. And it's kind of starting now because there is so much global debt that a lot of African nations have. They're driving down the price of what it takes to become a part of those nations, right? And it's very easy for millionaires and billionaires to go to the continent and find a bunch of land, purchase it, and hire a bunch of people to do things at a very cheap price. And it may appear to be good for the country and it may appear to be good for the continent, but it sets up something that I think every nation fights against after a while when you think about things like colonization. I recently read about Jack Dorsey going to Nigeria, and he's spending like 3 months in Nigeria looking for ideas for startups. And I think two ways about it. You know, my first way is, yeah, that's great. It's positive. We do need entrepreneurs to be mentored and encouraged, especially on the African continent, which is the richest continent on the planet, right? When it comes to natural resources, when it comes to people. You know, Africa is speculated to be where we're going to all be getting our food from because of climate change. However, if we're setting up, you know, a hierarchy where American CEOs go over to the continent of Africa and literally create a corporatocracy. And we're not doing well for the continent. And, you know, my fear is 20 years from now, the people of Africa will be low-wage workers, and the foreigners who came over as CEOs will be controlling not only the economy, but the rate of growth on the continent. And I only fear that because that's what's happening everywhere else. I mean, if you look at India, India probably has the most, the highest skilled low-wage workers probably in the world. And, you know, and it has nothing to do with the fact that they all speak English and they all are, you know, talented programmers. That has everything to do with there is a lot of poverty there. And people need jobs. So, you know, that's my fear. Coding is going to become the low-income work, right? And there's this huge push in Africa for Africans to learn coding. But why are they coding is the question.
Yeah.
If they're coding just to be punching numbers for a CEO that's going to be paying them 10 cents an hour, like... Coding is, you might as well be digging ditches. It's the same kind of blue collar work. So that's my concern about what's going to be happening on the African continent, you know, and I'm constantly watching it.
It makes me wonder if it has anything to do with population size, because you mentioned Africa, or you mentioned India, which has a huge population. And it makes me wonder if maybe there's, you know, maybe there's, it could have something to do with just how many people are looking for work there. And it's like supply and demand. So there's so many people there that it's not that big. You don't get paid that much because everybody's competing for the same work.
And we see
the same thing in China. You know, China's another example. And it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting argument because Africa and India are in population booms right now, and they're set to outpace the population of the entire world in the next century. So if that's true, what you're saying, then population is incredibly important, and one of the best things we could do in those countries that already have lots of people is not to not have kids, because, you know, people want to have kids. But, you know, it is just it becomes a population conversation, which is interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the strongest things we can do is educate women and girls.
Yes.
That is when women and girls are educated, they have a lot more opportunities, especially with technology, to join the workforce and, you know, subsequently have less children. So because they don't have time, and they're focused more on their profession and their ambition than they are with having kids. So, you know, Kevin Kelly talks about how depopulation is probably going to be the next epidemic in the world because of more women and girls moving to cities and looking for careers and not families. But, you know, he's right about the fact that that's a good way to think about, you know, slowing down the rate of the population growth. And when you do that, there's less competition, and with less competition, wages go up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a partial fix. Africa has a lot of, you know, old school ideas when it comes to that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's going to be very difficult to fight through those old school ideas. But, you know, in general, women and girls don't get educated at the rate of boys do. Changing, and, you know, it's changing a bit, but it's still, you know, it's still a stigma. Some, you know, it's still the idea of, you know, the older Africans, that's, you know, the women and girls, they stay home and work the farm. They're heads of the household, and they're not in the professional world, and they're not in the business. And, you know, competition between men and women is frowned upon. It's looked down on. You know, not so much in the Western world, in the United States, but in China, too. Like, competition between men and women is frowned upon. You know, women don't get the opportunities because they don't want men don't want women to compete with them. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, at the end of the day, that's what it is. But yeah, educating more women and girls controls that population problem.
Yeah, it also seems like a very slight argument against, and I say slight because I'm not personally opposed to capitalism, but it does kind of beg the question about a free market and the competition and things like that. As you said, as there's less competition, wages go up. But obviously, a free market and competition is healthy to a certain extent, and we've seen that in the world. We've seen the positive impacts of competition. But it does kind of seem like maybe the scales might be too competitive right now, because if people aren't being paid fairly for their work, then, you know, it could potentially raise some questions about capitalism.
Yeah, and there are too many people at the bottom. I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have in a capitalist society, is like there are so few people at the top, right? Mm-hmm. But those few people control most of the people at the bottom. So most of the people at the bottom have to do whatever they can in order to survive. And that type of structure is unsustainable. Every society that's had that type of structure has disappeared off the face of the earth. Like, we can't sustain it. So, you know, a lot of times we talk about, especially on my podcast, we talk about what's next. And again, we don't disparage the systems that are happening now, right? Because there's nothing you can do about it. We live in a capitalist society right now. And saying that capitalism is bad or good doesn't help you get to what's next, right? I'm developing this card game called Afrorhythms from the Future, where it's a set of cards that allow you to speculate about the future. And when you play this game, you can take on ideas like democracy. You can take on ideas like capitalism. You can take on ideas like geopolitics and patriarchy and you know, economic disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And once you take yourself out of this real situation of how do we fix the world and put yourself in this game, it allows you to use your imagination and figure out creative ways to find solutions to the problems that we face, right? And the funny thing about playing this game, every time I've played it, is nobody talks about money. Nobody talks about a currency. You know, which leads me to believe that it's not as important as we think it is. You know, everybody in the game, when we play the game, and I've played this game with a myriad of people from all kinds of diverse backgrounds, and nobody talks about having to have money. Humanity is enough. Like, being here is enough. And I always find that interesting. Like, if you think about our speculative fiction that we love, like Star Trek, nobody really talks about money in Star Trek. The Federation has done away with it. You know what I mean? Like, the Ferengi, they talk about money, but no one else. Like, that's not the commodity. The commodity is exploration and human experience. So I think, personally, and I'm generally an optimist, I think that's who we are as humans. I think we actually care more about each other than we do about things, than we do about monetary gain. We're given these things, right? Mm-hmm. These things are thrown at us, and it excites a part of our brain, you know, that amygdala, which is the fight or flight, which is like, I gotta have this or else I'm going to die. I gotta have this or else I'm going to starve. I gotta have this because I can't. But honestly, I don't think that's who we are. I think we see that we're more similar than we are different. I think that we care about one another more than we want to get over on one another. And I think once we figure out how to get rid of this idea of greed and share the idea of abundance amongst one another, then that's when we'll turn a corner. You know, that's when we'll have warp drive. That's where we'll be able to have a federation of planets. And, you know, it might take the Vulcans coming down and scaring the shit out of us. You know what I'm saying? It might take an alien invasion. I don't know. But I think inherently human beings, we we do believe that we need each other.
I want to say two things on that. I think that you're right about the amygdala, and I think, but I would also say that it's not that that's not who we are, because I think that that's obviously it's a clear part of our makeup. It's there. Those impulses have a reason. If we didn't have fight or flight, we probably wouldn't survive. So they serve as a basis for survival to an extent. But I think what you're saying is that we're mammals, more importantly, and we can be collaborative, and we can build on that need to survive, and we can go past it. And there's a better set of impulses that we can rely on, which is being good mammals and caring about each other and having empathy. And I think that's what you're saying. But I also want to just be careful that I'm not saying that I speak against capitalism, because I feel like I might have implied that earlier. And I do think capitalism is a positive force. And I think that, you know, it incentivizes entrepreneurship and it incentivizes good ideas to rise to the top. But I do think that you're right, Ahmed, that right now there's this disparity, especially in places like India and Africa and China, where there's so many people who are just working for pennies, and it's not fair. And I think, you know, maybe it's not so much an argument against capitalism as it is like taxes or something like that. I don't know.
Well, I think it's an argument against greed. And also, I believe that the amygdala has been really manipulated in us for centuries now. And now we believe that fight or flight is the only way to live, right? And I do agree, when we were lesser primates on the African savanna, fight or flight was the reason why we survived, right?
Yep.
We were, as you know, as the great apes, As an ape, we were prey. That's who we were. We were food. We didn't have, you know, technology to protect us until a lot later in our existence as human beings. So that part of our brain is a part of our brain for a reason. It does make up who we are. However, I believe in modern times, that part of our brain has been so stimulated and so used against us to make us make decisions and make us make choices against our better interests, that we have to have a real conversation about what we're doing. We have to have a real conversation about why we're doing it. What's the motivation for it, right? Is the motivation to be a billionaire? And once you're a billionaire, is that enough? I happen to know several billionaires personally, and none of them are fucking happy. So what's the goal here? You know what I'm saying? And if we are to be capitalists, what is that capital for? Like I said, I'm dispassionate about it. I don't speak for or against capitalism. I just want to know what the motivation is. You know, where are we going?
Bill Gates seems pretty happy, but he's also a pretty philanthropic dude.
I mean, I think it's to create the incentives that drive technology that increase the standard of living for all people, right? Like, there are incentives there, because you're right.
That'd be wonderful.
It doesn't make you happy. You're absolutely right. Julie and I were talking about this earlier, but it does, because it stimulates the amygdala. It is a lure for people, so it's kind of like incentive creation for people to want to pursue opportunities, and that creates technologies that hopefully help people and stuff. I'm a huge Star Trek fan. I don't know that a moneyless future is possible, though. I'm pretty pessimistic about that. I think going in that direction is a good idea, but I think it's a bit utopian, and it really doesn't respond to human nature, because you're right. Human nature is collaborative, but it's a mix. And the problem is, it's kind of like evolution. And if you have something that kind of a covenant that, you know, most people agree to, but people can benefit by cheating, by not following that, that's going to be a successful strategy that is going to eventually swamp all the people who are collaborative. So I think it's just not a problem that can be solved in that way, by having like kind of a universal federation system that's moneyless. I don't think it corresponds very well to human nature.
Well, here's what I'll say to that. The thing, and you know, now we're talking Star Trek and speculative fiction, but the thing, the reason why I think it works in the Federation is because they have the ability to construct and deconstruct matter. It's replicators, yes, right?
Totally.
The fact that they can replicate things,
anything they want,
they can
give everybody
everything, so they don't need money.
Yeah, because material becomes meaningless, essentially. Actually, that's something I wonder, is why are the Ferengi obsessed with Latinum if they could just replicate anything they want?
Latinum. But I think the Ferengi are like gambling addicts. They're addicted to the chase, right?
Yeah,
and the Latinum is just like, the Latinum is just a marker that says, you know, I'm winning the game. They're addicts, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is why I really like that layer that they have, you know, in the story. But yeah, once we're able to, you know, and who knows, maybe Higgs boson will come up with the God particle, we'll figure out how fucking all of that shit works, and dark matter and all of that crap, we'll figure out what that is and be able to create shit and give everybody everything.
I also wonder, though, is that going to make us happy? Because, like, then basically, so if we can provide everyone with everything they want, then everyone's basically retired. Retired people are often not happy because then they have no, like, challenge, right? If you can just get everything you want, like, what's the point of living if you're just getting everything on a silver platter, right? Like,
I think that's the question. Yeah, I think that's a very great question. What now, right? And I think it's going to be a bit of chaos for a while. I think everybody's going to have a hard time trying to figure it out. And then we're going to get through that and figure out what it is. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not afraid of that question. I'm actually looking forward to answering questions like that, you know, especially when you're when you're talking about technological advancement. Like, if you make something that can create whatever kind of matter out of thin air, are you going to give it away? Will that be open source? Or is that going to be something that's going to make the next billionaire, trillionaire? So
far? Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
if the robots take all our jobs, but they can produce so much material that we can give it out for free, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Right.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, is phase one of this is the universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to answer that question, you know, whether or not we can replicate matter. And I think that'll probably be the first wave of this conversation, is how should money be distributed when robots are just making it for us?
Well, I mean, these are questions that we're going to have to talk about.
Well, yeah, Bill Gates thought that robots should be taxed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
But I think the most interesting aspect that I hear here is that, you know, going back to the amygdala versus mammalian brain and things like that. And you know, civilization is arguably definitively mammalian, because reptiles, like, you know, they're just all out for number one, and like, they eat their own kids and stuff like that, and they don't really think about collaboration because it has no value to them. They're reptiles, so, like, you know, civilization has to become more, you know, mammal centric, arguably, because it's, you know, I think you're right, Ahmed, and that I think a lot of people do live stuck in their fight or flight instincts, and I think that does hold people back, and I think only when we work together collaboratively do things really work.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'd agree with that for sure.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. We should do this again sometime. Ahmed, thanks so much for making the time. Would you like to plug anything while you're here? Obviously, check out your podcast. I want to plug that, Afrofuturism. When do you post?
Yeah, it's the Afrofuturist podcast. I usually post twice every second and fourth Thursday of the month. Actually going through a whole bunch of rebranding for the podcast, and we come back next year. Right now we have the archive started in 2017, and so everything is up still. We talk to a lot of great thinkers, a lot of great scientists, technologists. We're going to be doing a podcast based on the science speed dating that we just did over at UCLA, which was a lot of fun. And then everyone who was on that panel is going to be on their own separate podcast, because I just love talking to them so much. I am doing an event on January 16th at the California African American Museum talking about radical imagination, and have some really great guests. Dr. Lonnie Brooks is going to be with me, who is the co-creator of the Afrofuturist podcast. Dr. Anthony Sparks, who is the showrunner for the OWN show, Queen Sugar, is going to be there talking about radical imagination, and a couple of other special guests as well. That's January 16th at the California African American Museum. What else am I doing? Doing a new show for Disney Plus, Jedi Temple Challenge, which is coming out in July, believe, where I play a Jedi Master, and I take children 10 to 14, put them through three challenges in order to become Jedi. And then I have a one-man show, which is talking about all my experience playing Jar Jar and the backlash of Jar Jar in 1997, 1999. And that's being directed and executive produced by my great friend, Mr. Frank Oz.
Oh, cool.
Wonderful.
And that should be on stage somewhere by August.
Cool. And any listeners, if you haven't seen that YouTube video, I guess is the main source. Anyway, there's this wonderful YouTube video that Ahmed did. You should definitely check it out. About his experience with Jar Jar. Yeah. I just want to say also, one of my best friends, he was a huge Jar Jar fan, so not everyone was a hater.
Nice. Yeah, thank you. It's actually just coming around now, you know, now that the new movies are out, there are a lot of kids who grew up with Jar Jar who really loved him and are now being quite vocal about it. Yeah. So always appreciate that.
Yeah, that character was historic. I mean, like, it was... Andrew brought up earlier that it was the very first full CGI main character of any TV show or movie. So that must have been that's probably a separate conversation what that experience was like, but we'd love to hear about that sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to come back on and share that.
Well, it sounds like you're super busy, Ahmed, so thanks for making the time. I'm going to plug your Twitter real quick. Follow Ahmed on Twitter, Ahmed Best, AHMEDBEST. And if you want to follow Andrew and I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. We do these episodes every Monday, and we hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.